Good evening, and welcome to Sun Sounds Radio, sunsounds.org, and the weekly reading of the Phoenix New Times. I'm your host, Bob Streit, and I'm here to read from the January 30th to February 5th edition. That's volume 51, number 5. We will start, as always, with our cover article. This week, it is a look at the ancient and modern foods of Arizona by Chris Malloy. And then we'll move on to a few other articles. Danny's local dish, music that makes you text your ex. Comedian Bobcat Goldthwait might make a musical comedy. An article entitled Bloomberg to Campaign in Arizona as Other Democrats Focus on Earlier Primaries. And then there's one on season 2 of Plate and Pour with Chef Mark Tarbell, starts tonight on Arizona PBS. We better read that. And we'll close, as usual, with arts and cultural event notices as time allows. Glad you're here. Get yourself a cool beverage and a comfortable chair, and we will get rolling. Okay, here we go. A look at the ancient and modern foods of Arizona by Chris Malloy. In 2019, Phoenix New Times began probing the margins of Arizona food culture in an attempt to eliminate a specific type of cuisine emerging in America's great Sonoran Desert and to highlight the overlooked people working magic with ingredients used here for centuries. We ventured out into the state's arid wilds and culinary unknown, spotlighting artisans that were pioneering new approaches to food, perfecting timeless regional dishes, and otherwise honoring the quirky, elusive, singular, gem-like ingredients of the desert. Sonoran Arcana. The resulting column, 10 of which are excerpted below, helped shed light on arcane Sonoran foodways and define what we came to call new Arizonan cuisine. All right, here's the first. Foraging wild food in the paved streets of Old Town Scottsdale. In a northern sweep of a 120,000 square mile desert, under palm trees and faint sound waves flowing from distant saloons and the odd busker teasing an electric kora, a tented bazaar hums. It hums in the center of streets of western junk shops, clothing boutiques, hums on byways that swell at night with beautiful people in various stages of dress and intoxication, funneling to and from nightclubs. It hums a warren of food vendors, a Rivendell of perfume, lemons, and bao buns jammed with chorizo, a tranquil nexus of sellers and buyers who eat well. This bazaar, you may know, is the Old Town Scottsdale Farmers Market. One of its roughly 100 vendors, Mark Lewis, believes that some of the market's best food comes not from its stands. He believes that it grows wild, ripe for the plucking from the ground. In dirt beds, in alleys, in seed clusters and tree pods, by steam pipes near car tires, under time-worn adobe facades more than 3 feet thick, food grows in Old Town on streets we heedlessly walk, a universe of edible plants. On an early winter Saturday, Lewis, a botanist, a former ASU professor, a graying man with khakis, glasses, and pie-pie blood, started his edible urban plants tour. Okay, Lewis said, crouching in an empty parking space, gesturing at a 2-foot plant. So the area we are at right now, probably you wouldn't think too much about this being a place where you want to get your food. But if you look down at the wall here, you see this plant sticking out. That's amaranth. Amaranth is a New World plant. It was a staple of indigenous Americans from the Aztecs to Tohono O'odham. You can eat its seeds and greens. Lewis is highly aware of the past, plant and human. His market stand's name is, oh, forgive me here, folks, Chamachiyakiyakai. Korikui. 8,000-year-old crops. Ancient future foods remembered. After identifying amaranth, he looks to others, sharing its asphalt crack. This right here is the triangle leaf, he says. This is quinoa. This is the relative of the expensive plant that you get at the supermarket. Lewis rounds a cinder block enclosure, turns down an alley, and in an even tone, he speaks with the erudition of a man who eats a diet of more than 75% foraged food, with the thought trains of a botanist who savors most of the Sonoran's many edible plants. In the alley, Lewis identifies lamb quarters. All of our modern lettuces have been bred out of a plant like this. He stoops to a growth of mustard and greens. They're perfectly edible. Lewis emerges from the alley, turns onto Second Street. A white sedan sloshes past, then a yellow sports car. He points out aloes and grasses. Nearing the end of the tour, after whipsawing his listeners with Latin and Tohono plant names, Lewis walks north and turns into a wide alley. He has one more plant to showcase. Tomatoes. Lewis stops when he gets the back of a restaurant, freezing at the head of a parking spot. There's your maters right there, he says. When you look at them, there's flowers on them. Now, later in the season, they'll have fruit. Every year, they have fruit. They're beautiful little tomatoes. The unmistakable spade-shaped leaves and starry yellow flowers tremble in light wind. Lewis just stares. So we're surrounded by food, he says, turning back to the market tents now visible. People say, I don't have room for a garden. But plants don't care what you have room for. They come right up. In the next article in this series, dates are the syrupy dark horse of Arizona agriculture. Once upon a time, Arizona was a major date state. It began when date palms were brought to the Americas by Spanish missionaries in the early days of colonization. Around the start of the 20th century, these trees and their descendants were no longer producing in large quantities, so the U.S. Department of Agriculture began to import dates from places like Morocco, cherry-picking favorites from the world's 3,000 varieties. In the U.S., date palms grow only in Southern California and Arizona's Sonoran Desert. Fatefully, the genus of the date palm is Phoenix. Charlene Badman of FNB is a big fan of dates. She'll toss a date called the Black Sphinx into preparations like a salad of Bloomsdale spinach, goat cheese, pita chips, and radishes sliced so thin they're virtually 2D. The Black Sphinx was discovered by Roy Franklin in Arcadia in 1928. Today, these dates still grow in Arcadia backyards. You can find them fresh come date season, early fall, at, for one, Sphinx Date Ranch in Scottsdale. And there, Rebecca and Sharon Seitz, carry on the specialty date business launched by Franklin and his associates before World War II. And depending on where you live in the valley, you might have an offbeat date varietal growing in your backyard. In 2011, I bought a property, and I didn't know what dates were, says Jana Anderson, owner of Pinnacle Farms, just west of South Mountain. And now I'm a date farmer, and I have more moctums than anyone in the state. This year, most of her crop of moctums, a wrinkly and rare Iraqi varietal, went to Cassie Shortino, chef at Trotto. Shortino uses them with pork. We cook them in sherry vinegar and sugar and make a kind of syrup, she says. We use that to glaze pork chops. The sugar coats the pork well and allows the meat to caramelize nicely. It also fits the restaurant's paradigm. Arizona, terroir, plugged into an old world blueprint. Just like the tale of dates in the Sonoran. The next piece is entitled The Most Ambitious Beer Project in Arizona. Beer equals wort plus yeast and time. Yet Chase Saravai, or Sareva, forgive me, Chase. Yet Chase Sareva, who gets paid to artfully navigate this equation, is driving two 350-gallon tanks of wort away from his Gilbert Brewery stocked with select yeast. That's because Arizona Wilderness Brewing Company lives up to its name. Sareva is headed out to make beer in the wild. Since opening in 2013, Arizona Wilderness, owned by Jonathan Buford and Patrick Ware, has pioneered the valley's beer scene, pushing what people drink in Arizona into funky, woody, sour, strange, beautiful, atmospheric territory. Buford Ware and head brewer Sareva, an editor's note here, Sareva recently left the brewery, produced thoughtful, dependable versions of beer styles widely popular in America, IPA, lager, etc., while leaning heavily on grain, fruit, and other inputs from local farms. But what makes Wilderness, or sets Wilderness apart, is its YOLO moonshot projects. Faders, mixed-style beers, beer-wine hybrids, and most of all, the biannual Camp Coolship Project, a pluperfect distillation of this brewery's local ethos and madcap style. Like ancient Egyptians, or the vintners recalled by Pliny the Elder, Sareva, driving into the wild for Camp Coolship 8, will be catalyzing fermentation using ambient microbes, tiny yeast floating around in the air. As 100% ambient yeast will be used, fermentation will be spontaneous and produce a wild ale. Without a prepackaged or otherwise tightly controlled yeast, brewers have limited leverage over how flavor will change, sour, funk, and wander. Parked, Sareva emerges. After greeting fellow campers from Wilderness and some brewery representatives invited from afar, Sareva, who looks like a young chemistry professor, lifts a tank's hose. He holds it over a shallow pan between the two truck-mounted tanks. Liquid, like milky chai, spreads thinly across the shallow pan, the cool ship. A smell of pretzel, freshly baked pretzel, diffuses. Jonathan Buford, wearing a brown jacket with prancing ponies, strums a guitar and sings improvised songs about wort and brewing. Gnats arc through the sunlight, bobbing and flitting erratically, randomly, invisibly, and so do tiny yeasts. Since 2016, when the project started, Wilderness has brought two versions of its mobile cool ship into the wild a total of 8 times. And because these fermentations take so long, only 2 of the 8 beers have been released. There are many obstacles to brewing a wild ale in the wild. Logistics, memory, weather, humidity. The mightiest is time. An Arizona Wilderness cool ship beer takes 1 to 3 years to ferment. This is liquid magic at the speed of continental drift. I think it captures a specific time and place, Sareva says, of culling wild yeasts and bacteria from the wilderness, because what's in the air right now isn't going to be what's in it tomorrow, 3 hours from now, 4 hours, or 3 years from now. It's capturing the here and now. Using wild yeasts forges a fleeting connection to an elusive present, to a concrete here and now. Wild microbes in the air change rapidly, from place to place, day to day, by the plants, animals, and seasons, and clouds, and wind, and raindrops, and guitar players, and human activity in the woods. When Sareva uses ambient microbes to catalyze fermentation, he is using microbes ephemerally alive in a time and a place of Arizona the world will never know again. He is locking that time and place into a bottle, writing its spirit into a beer. So what, then, will he be locking into Cool Ship 8? Once the cool ship fills, the day's work is finished. Wort stays out, microbes enter on their own, the brewers migrate to the lawn chairs by the bonfire and a long white tent, and jammy music and twangy country blast from Ware's truck. Ware passes around an experimental beer-wine hybrid. There are pastry stouts, double IPAs, Hellas, lagers, sours. Dusk falls. The white spotlight of a nearby camp sears the giant night. A portable grill throws the scent and sizzle of charring meat over the campfire. Stars punch through the inky veil, and yeasts float onto cooling wort. After midnight, it rains, and Zareva lets some collect and then covers the wort. In the morning, the cool ship has been uncovered. Zareva is off handling a carbon dioxide tank, soon to pump the wort back into the steel tanks. We got some rain last night, he laughs. Camp later breaks, and Zareva guides the mobile cool ship back to the highway. And later, he'll move the wort to 500-liter French oak puncheons, and there in the dark, wild yeast will awaken 4 days later to work their ancient magic, alchemy that will last up to 3 years when, upon release, even though Sereva's path as a brewer has since led him away from Arizona, the vanished time and place of Cool Ship 8 will rise to life again. All right, the next one. One of the world's best peppers is native to Arizona. Rene Andrade plops $4,000 in peppers onto a table at Ghost Ranch, the South Tempe restaurant where he is head chef. Though minuscule, wobbly ball red peppers pack a mighty punch, they are one of Arizona's great foods, the chiltepin. This is the pepper I grew up with, Andrade, a native of Nogales, Mexico, says over his chiltepin stash, dried from late 2018 harvests. This is the pepper that was in my life forever. I ate it on everything. I put it on everything. Salsa, ceviche, carne asada, drinks. During his childhood, Andrade would often travel to his family ranch in Baviacora, Sonora. On the ranch, wild shrubs begin to show color bursts in fall when their spicy fruit turns a florid red. The chiltepin is often considered the mother, the ancestor of all other chili peppers we know today. And it is much better than more common peppers. It has an intense, lemony, almost tropical brightness before its high-throated heat flares, burning with depth and gentle fury. It can be up to 20 times hotter than a jalapeno. And despite its virtues, the pepper remains something of an outsider in Metro Phoenix. You are more likely to come across its descendants. One obstacle is that the pepper prefers to live and die without human intervention. It staunchly resists gardens and farms and, besides, tastes best wild. Like most other very hot peppers, the chiltepin is more than just heat. The appeal of the world's hottest peppers is rooted in many things, and among them, the tiny beautiful flavors that flash before the heat strikes. A pepper might bring notes of smoke, cinnamon, and citrus before the tidal wave of fire. The chiltepin's intensely fruity character has drawn a cadre of supporters. It's bright and packs a giant bang of flavors, says Silvana Salcido Esparza of Barrio Cafe. I personally think it's the most flavorful of all chilies. Esparza uses them in agua chile and pozole. Charlene Badman of F&B uses them to top off fried eggs. Chris Bianco describes the chiltepins as hot and delicious and much more powerful than their heat index. I spent years trying to get this obscure mushroom from China, and now I'm getting it, Matt Carter, chef behind The Mission and other Valley restaurants, says of the chiltepin. Now, that's cool, but not as cool as this pepper. In an effort to get more people to adopt this fiery chili of his youth, and not wanting the tradition of it to die, Andrade did something remarkable late last spring. He gave away most of those $4,000 worth of peppers, spreading the love and the fire. You don't hear that very often, someone giving the good stuff away. All right, the next one is shepherding the crops of Arizona's past into the present. Just a short drive from Metro Phoenix in a part of the Gila River Valley, where the river has dried up due to upstream human diversion, the Buttons, led by Terry and Ramona Button, keep Ramona Farms with a Spartan rigor and boundless love. Here are ancient, modern, indigenous crops that are made for their environment. and taste great. Yet only a handful of eateries in the Phoenix area use them. Their daughter, Velvet Button, starts to leave the garbanzo field, and she stops on the edge and plucks a pod from a low plant, similar to all the others in the yellow rows around her. The lumpy pod looks about as moist as a ruffled potato chip. Velvet rolls the pod between her fingers. It crushes to dust and blows away. Parched garbanzos remain, jewels of the low field, drying before the harvest. Beneath Velvet's strappy sandals, the soil is fabulously cracked, like thin ice on a pond. Only there won't be any ice anywhere on this June day. The heat is well on its way to triple digits over Ramona Farms. Velvet trades the garbanzo fields for her car. Driving, she points out an alfalfa field. She talks about hospitals and canal projects, about local artist Amel Pedro and Akamel Udom, legend Chief Azul, the tribe's last chief. And soon, the low green shoots of a cornfield show. Velvet parks. She walks into the rows of young plants. The machine gun trilling of a killdeer is muffled by the vast chorus of crop leaves rustling. The field holds a Hopi blue corn varietal, still a few weeks from harvest. It also holds Pima 60-day corn, an Akamel Udom mainstay known as Ki'ikum Hu'un. Folks, pardon my pronunciation or mispronunciation of this ancient language. I mean no offense. When it's grown in optimal temperatures, it's gangbusters, Velvet says. That corn grows like crazy. Area chefs do many things with Ramona Farms corn. Velvet herself has many uses for it. She nixtamalizes corn using bean and wood ash. She makes tamales, porridges, mush, tortillas, corn smet, and other old and new preparations. Velvet climbs back into the car. The green acreage and blue sky and the low bowl of mountains slide by in a bucolic dream. We pass concrete canals skirting fields. Ramona Farms uses flood irrigation, letting pumped groundwater course across fields, watering crops. This is possible because Velvet's uncle painstakingly leveled fields using lasers. Land he has reshaped, Velvet says, is flatter than a pool table. Velvet now parks at a golden wheat field. Ramona Farms cultivates Pima, Durum, and White Sonoran wheat. The young wheat riffles and rustles in the wind with a colossal string sound, giving the field the peaceful magic of a golden ocean. After talking about wheat-based indigenous foods like semet and pinole, Velvet makes for a plot of tepary beans. These are leafy, shifting shoots in clods of brown soil. They point at distant sacred mountains, and when the plants are ready for harvest, beans will be white, brown, and black. Velvet notes that her family bred the black tepary, this chukbavi. White tepary beans, Velvet notes, are sweet and buttery with a smooth texture. Brown tepary's are nutty and earthy with a texture of boiled pecan. They keep their shape when boiled. In a nice brothy soup, they showcase like little river petals. They're so pretty, Velvet says. And when you cook the brown tepary bean, oh my gosh, the kitchen smells like rain. Well, that was a beautiful note to end that piece on. All right, an amazing desert food might grow in your backyard. A lot of people don't know about mesquite, says Tamara Stranger, chef at Cotton and Copper in South Tempe, and it grows everywhere, in the city, and most people have it in their yards. Stanger, an exponent of forage and wild foods, starts to gather mesquite pods for culinary use come early summer, the beginning of their season. She uses mesquite pods in an array of preparations, right in line with her reputation for skill and creativity with wild foods. She started using the desert-adapted legume years ago when she was baking at Pig and Pickle, where, from time to time, she'd mix mesquite flour into bread dough. Though mesquite has long been an arboreal icon of the Sonoran, only three of the trees, more than three dozen species, are Arizona natives: honey, velvet, and screwbean. These trees thrive in minimal rain thanks to roots that can tunnel 70 feet deep. Their bluish leaflets swish as the monsoon winds pick up, as if about to reveal some great final secret. They smell ashy and pungent when burnt. They give smoke that imbues food with sharp flavor. They can be shrubs, dwarf trees, or 20 feet tall. Their pods are eaten by jackrabbits, songbirds, livestock, and other animals like us. Felicia Cocotzen Ruiz, a traditional healer, chef, and indigenous foods activist, uses many parts of the mesquite tree for a variety of purposes, including the pods for food. Most people think of it kind of as a nuisance, she says. For me, it's an ancestral food and a food that has nourished my family for thousands of years. Ruiz, who came to the valley from Tiwa country in New Mexico, harvests mesquite until early summer monsoons arrive. She uses pods for syrup, traditional drinks, a porridge like cream of wheat, and much more. Like any foraging, collecting mesquites, comes with a set of the best practices that should be researched beforehand. The cardinal rule is to skip pods falling to the ground. But there are others, and that's why rare services like those provided by Greg Peterson of GrowPHX, Grow Phoenix, are useful. In early summer, in conjunction with Grow Phoenix and Desert Harvesters, Peterson set up his recently purchased mill at the Urban Farm Fruit Tree Program Nursery and ground mesquite for all comers. Some 26 pounds went to Peggy Sue Sorensen, a wild foods enthusiast who teaches classes on mesquite. Before I go on, I should mention that we've neared the halfway point of the reading of the Phoenix New Times on Sun Sounds Radio, sunsounds.org. And I'm glad you're here with us. And we will continue with our cover article. Early summer mornings, Sorensen often spends hours gathering pods, but only from the most flavorful trees. She says that some trees have pods that taste great, while others aren't worth picking from. Sorensen is known among friends for a drink she makes from mesquite pods and water. She calls the coiled 6 to 8 inch pods the sugarcane of the desert. All right, the next one here, how Kai creates new high-end Arizona food. It's just after noon on a Saturday, the second day Ryan Swanson has been developing a new dessert. The Kai chef's creative process often takes 5 weeks of tinkering, leaving time for any possibility to emerge. The dish being created on this morning off, a Sonoran riff on key lime pie. I kind of wanted to do a key lime pie, but with cactus, he says. Instead of key lime, I wanted to do nopales. Since opening in 2002, Kai has been a leader in writing the next chapter of Arizona food. Swanson and the head chefs before him have devised artful menus that exalt and elevate Sonoran ingredients. Many come from the Gila River Indian community, which owns the celebrated restaurant. And like the rest of Kai menu, Swanson's key lime pie will be a creation new to the world. A small pie made the previous day sits on a ceramic plate, its center glistening a pale green from cactus. The plate sits under four sleek hooded copper lights. Swanson hoists a tank of liquid nitrogen and pours. Liquid nitrogen collects in a copper saucepan, and cold fog plumes over the metal table, curls down its sides. Swanson produces a plastic bottle of prickly pear gastrique, a fuchsia liquid mixed with lime juice, lime zest, and elderflower vinegar. He squeezes drops into the pot, and they freeze instantly, creating, Swanson says, dippin' dots. They're usually 8 bullet points I go through when I'm making a dish, Swanson says, as he reaches for a plate so he can begin assembly. 8 number points face him, scrawled on paper. 1, what's the theme? 2, what's the story? If I had to give this a story, I'd probably dedicate it to Velvet Button, Swanson says. She foraged all these ingredients, or they grew it at Ramona Farms. And this is kind of a tribute to Velvet for all her hard work. Number three, what's the flavor season? Number four, what's the idea? In this case, the idea is to channel Key Lime Pie's vivid tang using desert plants, mostly cactus. Number five, what's the plate? The plate is a saucer sloping up to a raised circular hollow. Now, Swanson sets the pie in the hollow. Atop the pie, he adds a flat circle of meringue, perfectly cut to fit the hollow, obscuring the pie beneath. Six, how to serve it? Seven, does it suck or does it work? That's a key question to consider. And number eight, what's the name? Quickly, Swanson zests a lime over his dish yet to be named. Like sound, the fruit's perfume instantly fills the kitchen air. And from here, assembly is swift, and a flurry of spooning and tweezing ingredients appear atop the white meringue. Swanson adds citrus lace, small green growths from orange trees. He purchased two neon yellow cucumber flowers. Cucumber, and I think lime and cactus, they all just go together, he says. And moving to the stove, Swanson quickly heats up a saucepan of the purple gastrique and then brings it and the plated pie out to the dining room. And standing at a table, holding the saucepan high, he tilts the rim. Drops of purple splash atop the cactus pie's white meringue. With a flute soaring from a hidden restaurant speakers, Swanson tastes the first version of his new dessert. Well, I wonder how it tasted. All right, the next one here is called Growing Grapes and Making Wine in the Desert. The climactic quirks of southern Arizona test vintners. Monsoons, for one. Spring frosts can also wipe out crops after bud break, the visible beginnings of the annual growing season. And even apart from climate, there are the variables beyond lack of knowledge that come with being a younger wine region. Kent Callahan of Callahan Vineyards believes the desert has qualities that give wines unique thumbprints. In the wine world, there is the pervasive idea of terroir, the notion that the taste of a place comes through, that the sunshine and farmer and methods and harvest and soil and humidity and wind and rain shape flavor. For example, Chablis has a chalky flavor because of the soil its Chardonnay grapes grow in. Similarly, the Arizona desert has its own territorial signatures. Between the iron and the calcium here, you definitely get distinctive characteristics, Callahan says. The wines here have denser tannins. You can feel it in the mouth. It's more concentrated. There's more guts. Arizona wines, like the wines of any place, vary between growing regions and vineyards. But there are general tendencies that can be underscored in places like Callahan, where old world varieties thrive. A specific Callahan wine with Burgundian roots is what got Sam Pillsbury of Pillsbury Wines into Arizona winemaking in the first place. I discovered a Chardonnay made by Kent Callahan, he says. It was the most extraordinary Chardonnay I had ever had in my life. After tasting this wine, Pillsbury drove down to Willcox the next day and bought 40 acres across the street from the plot of grapes that Callahan used. After pondering opening a vineyard in his native New Zealand, Pillsbury, decades later, is thrilled to be in Arizona. The high desert is amazing because it's so clean, he says. There's not the concerns about things like rot, which you have in more humid climates. The Chardonnay that we grow is just insane, he says. Pavel Milik, beverage director at F&B and owner of nascent Los Milik's winery, echoes the view that desert wines turn out a little differently. Unique, he says, is an understatement. Callahan agrees, citing soil and sun, diverse planting to safeguard against climate variability, the scene's relative youth, and the fact that the people growing the grapes are still, at this stage, the same people running the tasting rooms. He says the wines in Arizona are so much better than they were 10 years ago that it's funny. The next one is The Desert Comes to a Farmer's Market Near You. Sonoran Scavengers, a new stand at the Old Town Scottsdale Farmer's Market, has products unlike the farmed fruit, farmed vegetables, and prepared foods sold by its neighbors. Karen Bedell sells jams made from forage, wolfberry, barrel cactus, prickly pear, mesquite, manzanita. She sells flour ground from amaranth, blue corn, and Palo Verde beans. She even bakes what she gathers into cookies, into muffins. Almost everything that we use is local to Arizona, with the exception of the pineapple, Bedell says, and most of it comes out of our desert. 24 years ago, Bedell came to Arizona for a six-month stay that never ended. The desert presented different plants, a different landscape. These days, Bedell does most of her gathering near Buckeye, her home. My backyard opens up to about 2,000 acres of farmland, she says, and that allows her to forage all the way to Gila Bend. She also gathers in Rainbow Valley, where she'll go camping, staying overnight in wild places to gather. Other times, she'll throw her kids in the car and head on a trip. They'll go forage, see a new town, an old mine. She doesn't stop for winter, like some Sonoran foragers do. The wolfberries, she said, in the fall, were just coming into bloom. Bigger fruit, like wolfberries and hackberries, do better when closer to a water source. Follow the washes, she says. I happen to know an area where water is close to the surface, and sure enough, the wolfberries grow better there. And so she ventures downstream, gathering in wild places. I read just about every book I could find on foraging, Bedell says, browsing the forms and colors of her wares, listening to her patiently explain the unknown to customer after customer, spooning bracing samples of mesquite and fig jelly. You believe her. Next one is Dreams of Perfect Desert Bread and Tortillas. Chris Lenza, executive chef and overseer of Cafe Allegro, has been tinkering with his mesquite dinner roll recipe for 10 years. And that's also how long the cafe has been around. Lenza, a sous chef at Allegro when it opened, took the reins of the ambitious program 2 years after it began. We source as much as we can within 150 miles of the museum, Lenza says. And that includes heritage corn, flowers, nopales, mesquite, and cactus fruit, tonged from the courtyard. All find their way into a seasonal menu. In 1 week, there might be a meatloaf of grass-fed beef and Hayden purple barley. Another, there might be pozole swimming with Ramona Farms Pima 60-day corn, served with grilled nopales tossed in prickly pear vinaigrette. And there might be a simple, warming vegetable soup that channels the rainy desert spirit of tepary beans. When Lenza speaks about desert ingredients, his eyes shine and his voice brims. I would be really upset with myself if I wasn't giving the guests local, regional cuisine, he says. Big projects seem to be what animate culinary artisans who embrace the ingredients of the Sonoran Desert. And having nailed his mesquite sourdough roll recipe after 10 long years of editing, and having developed a mesquite tolera roll for special occasions, having bullseyed a salsa fermented from guajillo chilies and prickly pear fruit, Lenza has moved on to his next big thing, heirloom Sonoran corn tortillas. This is what I do every Saturday, he says, his voice going low and furtive at one of his cafe's tables. I'm trying to figure out a way to make Ramona Farms heritage corn into a corn tortilla. Lenza says he has three tortillas just about down. The last step is to strike a balance between the absolute unconventional beauty of a tortilla made from these heirloom corn strains and what customers are expecting. He sits back in a cafe chair and slips into a big smile. Desert tortillas on his mind. His voice goes loud again. Lenza says, they're really good. Okay, and that ends this series by Chris Malloy. entitled A Look at the Ancient and Modern Foods of Arizona. Okay, I know that I mentioned that we would read Danny's Local Dish. However, this week's version of that ongoing series involves some concerts coming up prior to the broadcast of this show, as it turns out. So we'll move on to an article about comedian Bobcat Goldthwait, because he might make a musical comedy someday. This is by Amy Young. If we owe one thing to the Police Academy movie franchise that launched in 1984, it is the massive exposure it gave to then-burgeoning comedian Bobcat Goldthwait. It was his delivery that first dug his hooks into fans. A unique style was the second part of that 1-2 punch, and through a twisted snarl and sputtery vocal effect, he further engaged us as he dropped his brutally honest comedic bombs. His physicality, a simultaneous blend of reluctance and explosiveness, helped keep us on edge, eager to always follow him to the punchline. Over the years, his stand-up has become stylistically more straightforward, allowing the focus to remain on his continued ability to release brilliant insights, and whether he's waxing autobiographical or tackling social commentary. When Goldthwait isn't entertaining crowds via the stand-up forum, he certainly isn't lounging. Over the last 30 years, he's been acting, making movies, doing voiceovers, and directing. The latter includes several TV programs, from talk shows to dramas. On January 31st and February 1st, he returns to Phoenix for 4 stand-up shows at CB Live. And we got to talk with him about what attendees can expect, as well as his latest projects that involve comedian Dana Gould and filmmaker Judd Apatow. Phoenix New Times. You are back in Phoenix for a couple of nights worth of shows. What topics are on deck? Bobcat responds, well, it's always, at least for the past 15, 20 years, been about telling stories. My shows are still somewhat autobiographical, and I do that for a couple of reasons. One is that then you know the material is yours. Other people won't have the same stories, and then you're not derivative. Although I was in a car wreck with comedian Dana Gould, so he's probably got some of the same stories at this point. Oh, we didn't hit each other. We were in the back seat of the same car. The two of you are working together. Yes, he and I have been doing a 2-person show, and we're filming that at the beginning of February in Atlanta, Athens, and then Asheville. And that will end up being around 90 minutes and have somewhat of a documentary feel to it. In this show, the two of us are on stage together, not doing back-to-back performances. Speaking of documentaries, you made Call Me Lucky in 2015 about comedian Barry Crimmins. Now there's some new activity with this film. That's what I'm currently working on, making that a narrative movie version with Judd Apatow. Barry is an interesting character, stand-up comic and activist against child sexual abuse. How did you get interested in telling his story? Bobcat says, I've known Barry since I was a teenager, and I started doing comedy because he was running an open mic, and that's where I got my start. But why did I make the movie? There's a lot of reasons. I mean, I think one was that his story was so amazing. He went to the floor of the Senate and took on AOL because they were allowing child pornography to be openly exchanged. So it was a very Frank Capra kind of thing, you know, a little guy against the system. And that, along with my love for the guy, he's like a father figure. Have you worked with Judd Apatow before? No, but I've known him for a long time, since he was a PA and I was what I'm Adam Sandler's roommates. I'm pretty sure that's when I met him, because Adam was in my fine alcoholic clown movie, Shakes the Clown. New Times says, you're getting close to the 30th anniversary of Shakes, and are you going to do anything celebratory? We screened it for the 25th anniversary in L.A., and I was so surprised that it sold out. Shocked. The majority of the cast showed up, including Adam Sandler, Julie Brown, and Tom Kenny. It was really cool, and I was so surprised that it was sold out. I was shocked, and I don't know if I'll do anything for the 30th. Was it mostly longtime fans that came out, or do you think it's found its way to a new and younger audience? Oh, it's usually people 30 and older that seem to have a soft spot for it. You know, it wasn't very well liked when it came out, so it's weird to me that it has this cult following. In any case, I'm appreciative of it, but I think I may also do myself a disservice by making all my movies with such different tones from one another. Maybe if I hadn't, I'd have developed a bigger fan base as a filmmaker. You're staying true to your vision, though. Yeah, all these movies, they're very personal, and they're usually kind of a little bit slightly extreme. They each tend to develop a fan base, and it's funny that people who like one particular movie tend not to like the others. New Times says, how do you think the stand-up audiences have changed since you've been a comic? And Bobcat responds, I think the only difference is that audiences now have a voice. Besides heckling and writing the management, if people don't like something now, they are social media outlets. You don't seem rattled by that technological evolution. I think there are a lot of very successful comedians who just aren't used to anyone ever criticizing them. Now they're like, someone didn't like what I said when I marginalized a group of people. Hello? Right, there's no self-reflection with some folks that are being called out. Bobcat says, I've always had people not like what I do and weighing in on it, so this isn't new to me. I have moments where my comedy is still a little angry, or I might get a little too extreme, but honestly, it's calm. I find myself diffusing heckling situations when they get rough. There's so much anger in the world right now that contributing to it is a disservice. We're all walking a high-tension wire right now, says the New Times. And Bobcat says, it's insane. I've made fun of every administration since I started doing comedy, going back to Reagan. Yeah, but this is the first time that making fun of the president gets me death threats on Instagram, which is the most benign form of social media, by the way. And I joke, because it's funny to me, that the biggest insult in our day and age is that someone will unfollow you. I used to play arenas. A million people have actually unfollowed me. You're really late. This doesn't hurt my feelings. And he laughs. From directing episodes of shows like Jimmy Kimmel Live, Marin, and now Netflix's new show starring RuPaul, AJ and the Queen, to performing, your career is so diverse and prolific. What could you add to the resume? You know, I would really love to do a musical. I joke about that, but I really would. Is there one medium where you feel the most at home? I think being behind the camera is where I feel most at home. But I have to say, when I'm doing stand-up, I think, this is what you do, and this is fun. I'm just lucky that I get to do all the different things. What do you want people to know about you? And Bobcat says that when I am on stage doing my show, when I am on stage doing my show, I'm not just trying to pay the bills. I am thoroughly enjoying myself and so glad to be up there. And so ends this article about the comedian Bobcat Goldthwait, who's scheduled to perform on Friday, January 31st, and Saturday, February 1st at CB Live. And I'm sorry you'll only be able to catch the late show on Saturday at CB Live if you're hearing about it from this show. But I thought that was a pretty cool article, and he's an interesting guy. So forgive me. For a Saturday night broadcast about a Friday and Saturday show. More in a moment. Okay, we got time for a little bit of news. This article by Allie Swenson is entitled Bloomberg to Campaign in Arizona as Other Democrats Focus on Earlier Primaries. While most Democratic presidential candidates are spending time in the four states with the earliest primaries, Michael Bloomberg is according to Arizona Vote. The former New York City mayor and presidential hopeful announced on Wednesday he'll head to Phoenix this weekend for his second campaign visit, just 2 days before Monday's Iowa caucuses. He will be hosting an organizing event at his downtown Phoenix office on Saturday evening, with doors opening to the public at 5 p.m., the campaign said. Because Bloomberg announced his candidacy late in November 2019, he's purposely taking a different approach than his opponents, according to Joe Wolf, his senior advisor for Arizona. He knew he wasn't going to win the first few, Wolf said. And that's what happens when you get in this late. He's no dummy. He knew that. We're investing in states that other campaigns are not, to have more delegates. The four states with the earliest votes, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina, all have primaries and caucuses in February. And then on March 3rd, on what's known as Super Tuesday, 14 more states will cast primary votes. Arizona's March 17th presidential preference election comes later than all of those, but it will determine who 67 of the state's delegates will support at the national convention later this year. Bloomberg seems to have resigned himself to losing the first four states, and he set his sights farther out to Super Tuesday and beyond. And that strategy is wildly unusual and unproven. Successful nominees typically start with small state early victories and work their way up from there. But Wolf said Arizona voters will start filling out mail-in ballots in mid-February, and the state behaves somewhat like a Super Tuesday state, and therefore is still a major campaign target for Bloomberg. Arizona is an important piece for our path toward to win the nomination, Wolf said. This is the campaign we have to run to be successful. The billionaire candidate's financial investments show that. Bloomberg has a larger footprint in Arizona than any other Democrat. He's hired more than 50 paid staffers and plans to establish 6 field offices statewide. And last fall, Arizona was one of 4 states the candidate chose for $100 million worth of TV ads. Bloomberg also came to Phoenix on a campaign stop just over 2 months ago in November to file paperwork for the state's presidential preference election. Ahead of his Phoenix appearance on Saturday, Bloomberg will be in Denver for another campaign event. And though Bloomberg has funneled millions into campaign advertising across the country, the moderate Democratic candidate doesn't appear to be a front runner. Former Vice President Joe Biden, Senator Bernie Sanders, and Senator Elizabeth Warren, who has also established a campaign presence in Arizona, have him beat in recent national polls. And that was by Ellie Swenson. Okay, it's time for an article by Lauren Cusimano. Season 2 of Plate and Pour with Chef Mark Tarbell starts tonight on Arizona PBS. Arizona PBS has bigger than usual news. Plate and Pour is kicking off its second season on January 30th at 7 p.m. The Rocky Mountain Emmy Award-winning show is hosted by Chef Mark Tarbell, also of Tarbell's and The Tavern, who takes viewers to favorite Phoenix-area restaurants, markets, tap rooms and bars, and food-related businesses. Plate and Pour first premiered on January 10, 2019. In Season 1, Tarbell cooked and questioned at spots like Cotton and Copper, Little Miss BBQ, Brie, and Trotto, and spotlighted bartenders to beekeepers. Season 2 should be more of the same in a good way. A teaser for the 2020 episodes cuts in footage of Valley chefs like Talavera's Samantha Sanz, Barrio Cafe's Silvana Salcido Esparza, the 2019 James Beard Award-winning chef Charlene Badman, and a quick high-five with Chris Bianco. Viewers are promised visits to Welcome Diner, Gallo Blanco, The Churchill, and Hidden Track Bottle Shop. And that's just in the first episode. We're in a really beautiful time, Tarbell says, referring to the exploding restaurant scene happening in the Phoenix area. Tarbell says the second season has much smoother continuity between the segments, which he credits to driven production team members like segment producer Marjorie Punette, assistant production manager Ebony Delaney, executive producer Melissa Thompson, and Director of Content Jody Gottlieb, just to name a few. And two more. We have to be thankful to ASU and Arizona PBS for doing it and believing in it, Tarbell says. It's not hard finding restaurants to feature on the show. The small group of producers and others involved in programming do research, and Tarbell will throw in a few ideas, but now the crew is able to better receive feedback from the audience, which Tarbell says they weren't able to fully develop in the first season. The purpose is to find something that has a great story, he says. We're using food and restaurants and spirits and beer and wine as our foil, if you will, but it's really about the people and culture of Arizona. Even Tarbell, who's been in the Valley since 1986, is learning as he goes. What's interesting is, I know a lot of chefs, but one of the really great things about this show for me is actually I get to know them, he says. I might have known them for 20 years, but I actually get to have a conversation because in our worlds, we're just crossing paths all the time. And his favorite episode coming in season two, it's sort of like picking your favorite child, he says. They're all different, and I don't know if I have a favorite. However, he says interviewees like Charlene Badman stick out, referring to episode four when Badman leads the team through a Phoenix farmer's market. For me, that was a great one. There are many, but she's special. Despite the more polished look, the show remains fluid, which is perhaps the main difference between Plate and Pour and the former Check Please Arizona, but the objective of the former remains the same. One of the things I hope to do in my career, and now that I'd say I'm in the autumn of my career, I hope it's early autumn, is to have a chance to give back and celebrate and elevate the perception of what's happening with the people and culture and food in Arizona. To me, this is a way to represent and give back to the community that has been so good to me. And Tarbell says he's a passionate fan of what's happening here, whether it be representing through spirit distilleries, beer makers, winemakers, or restaurants. It's so textured and diverse, he says, and the general population just doesn't know. Tarbell says he's been lucky enough to travel and participate in kitchens nationwide as a chef, but says he'll still get the "why do you live in Arizona" look or flat-out comment. That kind of always annoyed me, and I don't think it's fair or true, he says. I don't think we're represented that well. Oh, and then he kind of concludes with, I have zero acting skills, so I am who I am, and I'm still working on me. It's a bit of a lifelong project, he says, full chuckle. But I don't know if I could be in this business for 25 years and not like people, and I generally do. There's a whole season of shows coming up, and for more information, see Plate and Pour website. And with that, I must thank you for being here for the reading of the New Times. You can hear it on Sunsounds, sunsounds.org, and we'll catch you next time.